Welcome. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. I'm going to read from a recent editorial by one of our guests. My mother had three children, worked all day, and was tired all night. In the hood, some parents collect a check from the government and are never home. Other parents work two jobs and are never home. Either way, the streets have a way of raising us all. When I was 13, I was looking up to the most notorious drug dealers in West Oakland. Most were between 17 and 25 years old, the youngest 14. I was what you would call a little homie. I was by no means a gangster, but I loved feeling like one. After the entire older crew was convicted of murder, I remember all of us little homies deciding whether we would inherit the block or walk away. I walked away. Not because I'm smarter or more humane than the others. I was able to walk away because enough people cared enough to put in enough time, resources, and energy to make me decide to walk away. He says, the truth about violence in Oakland is if enough cared enough to put in time, resources, and energy, it wouldn't exist. And those are the words of our guest, Gino Fajeda. He's a deputy for the Alameda County Sheriff's Department and the creator of the one-man show Cops and Robbers. Gino grew up in West Oakland and went into law enforcement, and he straddles that divide between the men in blue and the kids on some of the toughest streets of one of California's toughest cities. Hi, welcome.
Hey, good morning.
And you like to be called Jay?
You call me Jay. It's a lot easier.
And we're also joined by Paul Figueroa. He is the interim assistant chief with the Oakland Police Department. He directs basically the entire department, including CompStat, ceasefire, and outreach. And he's worked to create a model for building trust between police and community, right? That's what you got your PhD, was your dissertation?
Yeah, that was a dissertation topic. Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here, Paul.
It's great to be here.
And Akil Trusso is a community organizer in Oakland. He's an Oakland street outreach team leader, and he works with residents in some of Oakland's most violent neighborhoods, and he's connecting them with city services. Hi, Akil.
How you doing?
So what's interesting is that everybody here grew up in Oakland. Akil and Jay grew up in West Oakland, and Paul, you grew up in the Fruitvale neighborhood?
Yes.
So can you each talk about how your background, how where you grew up influences how you look at law enforcement? Why don't you start, Jay?
Well, I didn't know any cops personally growing up. It wasn't until later in life where, you know, I decided maybe something's wrong with that. If I don't know any cops personally, police are very powerful. It's a very powerful position. It's like one of the only positions in the country where you could decide whether or not, you know, American citizens go to jail or live or die. And I didn't know any of those people. So growing up, I was basically, listened to my mother. I listened to the other older people around me. I listened to the radio. I watched television. I didn't get too many positive images of the police.
Well,
and then
what
the
was
police
your...
that I did see, they were in action and they were detaining and arresting. And, you know, they were doing things to people that I knew.
How did you perceive the police? How did you view them?
I viewed them as an occupying force. People that just came into the community and took people away and left. And I didn't know any of them personally, so I didn't get a chance to know any of their positive attributes or characteristics. Like, you know, this guy may be a drug dealer. He may be selling drugs to pregnant women, but he's there every day. So I see some of the good in him, too. And then I see these guys in blue come in and then they take him away.
And you say you viewed him as sort of an occupying force, just coming in and making these raids and then leaving?
Right, because I'm operating from a limited capacity, limited exposure.
And what years were you growing up? You said it was during the height of the crack epidemic, right?
Exactly.
Well, so when is that?
That's the 80s.
80s, okay.
Yeah, so there were guys selling drugs on every corner, a number of prostitutes on my corner. There was crime everywhere. But like I said, I knew these people. And so I knew the good side of them, too. And I wasn't necessarily, as far as the bad things that they did, they weren't always out in the open. So I didn't necessarily know these people as bad people. They were more good than bad as far as I was concerned, because that was my reality.
So it'll be interesting to hear about why you went into law enforcement. But let's hear from Akil. So what was it like for you growing up in West Oakland? And how does that affect how you look at law enforcement and what maybe policing means?
Well, I could say I never judged the entire police force. you know, for the bad things that some of them looked like they were doing to me, you know, I judged them individually. So, you know, from what I seen, there was good cops, then there was bad cops. There were cops that did things that they shouldn't have done, and then there was cops that did things that they should have done, and I was glad they done it. And a lot of times, I was in the wrong. You know, I was trying to make money the best way I knew, which was, you know, illegally.
Doing what?
You name it. Drugs. You know, taking things that didn't belong to me. At gunpoint. Strong arm. So, you know, I kind of looked at it like they were doing their job. You know, I've always knew, even as a kid, without order, they'd be chaos. So I never really looked at the police as bad. I looked at what I was doing as bad. So I was blessed to really be able to see the truth.
And Paul, how about you? So you grew up in Fruitvale.
I did. I went to St. Elizabeth's Elementary School and then high school. So I had the kind of a private school experience within the inner city. But certainly growing up in the Hispanic areas, you had the Norteños that kind of controlled the area from the Hispanic gang side. And they were always at war with a group called the Cedeños or the Border Brothers, which were far east Oakland. And the interesting thing is the colors of the high school were red, which is a Norteño color at the time and still is today. My colleagues are smiling. So we had to be careful growing up about, you know, how often I wore red, where I wore it, you know, could I wear my high school colors and things. So just some of those survival things that didn't want to be involved in the game. Certainly had friends growing up that were part of the gang culture, but I was able to stay out of it. And it's important to understand that when I was 10 years old, my best friend's dad was killed. Tragically, a person was getting his car repossessed down the street, the person started shooting at the tow truck driver. And the bullets traveled down the block and killed my friend's dad as a result. And the way the police came in and handled it, because I had always seen them, and they seemed omnipresent in the neighborhood at times, and certainly, you know, walking to school, to and from school, in times where I would see them in difficult situations. But in this situation, they handled it very well, and the person was in custody very quickly. And it was really at that early age that I kind of began to draw an affinity towards, wow, you know, here's some folks in the neighborhood that can really make a difference. And as tragic as these circumstances are, I mean, my best friend's dad was the nicest guy in the world. And he'd walk out with wrinkled dollar bills in his hand while we were playing baseball and say, you know, I can't use these, and, you know, someone's got to take these. And we'd get a dollar.
These are all messed up.
Yeah, they're all messed up, and we'd get a chance to go get some stuff. And just a real, real nice guy. So even in the midst of that tragedy, the police were able to come in and bring some justice to that in the neighborhood. And one of the things I always point out and has still impacts me to this day is the effect that a homicide can have on a neighborhood. That the police can come in, do a phenomenal job as they did in this case, and which really began my interest in policing. But the neighborhood is still affected for so long. And so in some of our neighborhoods where you have, and this occurred certainly in the Fruitvale, but you have homicide after homicide on top of homicide, tragedy on top of tragedy on top of tragedy. And it really just leaves the neighborhood in just kind of a funk. There's really no other way to describe it. And so fortunately, there weren't a tremendous amount of violent crimes that took place in our neighborhood after that, and I think we were kind of able to come out of it. We were a close-knit neighborhood. And a lot of folks knew each other real well. But, you know, that helps me understand what's going on in our communities where, you know, it's just violent crime after violent crime after violent crime. And so that really has helped me be more understanding and compassionate as I've moved through my career and really increase my commitment to my job.
And that's Paul Figueroa. He's interim assistant chief with the Oakland Police Department. We're also joined by Akil Trousseau, who is an Oakland Street Outreach team leader. We'll explain what that is in just a moment. And Gino Ferreira, who's a deputy for the Alameda County Sheriff's Department. And he wrote and performed the one-man play Cops and Robbers. Sorry, I'm laughing there because I keep on butchering his name. Ferreira. Gino Ferreira. So, Gino, you said that you as a kid saw, growing up in West Oakland, saw the police as an occupying force. How did you end up becoming an officer?
I mean, well, it was a long story. I mean, a lot of books, a lot of reading, a lot of documentaries. And my degree is in Black Studies from San Francisco State. And the relationship between the Black community and law enforcement, it hasn't been a pretty one. It goes back centuries, and for the majority of Black people's time in this country, you couldn't call the police. You know, for the majority of time in Black people, majority of time of Black people in this country, you know, the police were there to return us to slavery after we escaped, and they were there to enforce Black codes and slave codes, and then later Jim Crow laws, and you know, so it's not until maybe 50, 60 years ago where we could actually pick up the phone and call the police in a general sense. So with all of that history and focusing on that and having friends, you know, in the streets that are, you know, doing wrong. But since they're my friends and I'm with them and I know their good attributes, that, you know, they're mostly right to me. I looked at the police as this foreign entity, and I didn't know any of them personally. But ultimately, as I got older and I began to take more responsibility for my community, I began to wonder things like, you know, why did this person get killed and everyone knows who did it, but no one's saying anything, you know? And then you would see a high profile case where an officer kills someone and, you know, everyone stands up. And this is not to say that people don't protest with black on black violence in the hood, because people do. People come out and they have vigils, and, you know, it's a feeling of sorrow. It's a feeling of, you know, why can't this just stop? We need to stop this. But when it's coming from the officer, and when it's an officer involved shooting, then it's a feeling of, we want justice. You know, we want this person to pay for this that has happened. And I began to see that as a barrier to us achieving justice. I began to see that as a barrier preventing us from actually stopping the violence, because the people that were violent, they're not at the vigil. You know, the people that did take that life or that are, you know, pimping little girls, they don't necessarily, they're not the ones out there, you know, crying, you know, with their hearts broken over what's happening and what's going on. They're in a chase for power, and they're competing against other factions that are also seeking power. So someone needed to stand up to that. And when I thought about it, I couldn't think of anyone better than me. You know, like I said earlier, police have a lot of power. They have weapons, they have training, and they have authority to use them. So at the end of the day, I felt if there was going to be anyone in that position riding around my community, then why not me? I couldn't think of any person better. So I spoke to my wife, and we decided that, you know, we would do it. Paid my way through the academy and went in, and I learned a lot. Like I said, I had not known any cops personally. I learned a lot, and I went in, and I'm still learning.
So let's all talk about this central question of, what does it mean to do good policing? What is effective policing, and how do you define that? You want to start, Jay?
Good policing, it's a huge responsibility. Policing in general, it's a huge responsibility. No one likes to be told what to do, especially adults. So I believe with that responsibility, you have to care about the community that you're policing. Because the best possible job, the most effective way to do your job is for someone to tell you who did it. That's the most effective way. And in order for people to tell you who did it, they have to trust you. But in order to trust you, they have to know you. And that's not to say that you have to be from that community, but they have to know who you are as a person. So that means they have to see you outside of your authoritative state. They have to see you just caring about them, just checking up on them. A lot of a lot of cops are so slammed from call to call to call, especially in departments when they only have a few people and they're in need for more bodies, that all they can do is go from call to call. They don't have time to stop, you know, just to, you know, say hi to someone. I want to reach
that. There's this history of deep distrust.
Right.
That it's harder to stop and say hi.
It's a history of deep distrust. And, you know, there, I don't really see an effort to go into that history, either on the part of the police or the black community. Like, no one's really digging for history right now. I want to reach that kid that was me. I want to talk to that kid.
So how do you reach that kid that was you? And I'm going to put this to Paul, too, and Akhil, because that's what your job is, Akhil.
Right.
So explain first for us, what is a street outreach team, and then answer the question of how do you reach that kid that was you? How do you stop this cycle of violence before it starts?
Well, a street outreach worker is a person that, well, the police serve and protect. We just serve. We have nothing to really protect with, but we just serve. We try to find out what the issue is with the kid. We try to find out what the kid's needs are. Does this kid need a job? Does he need some type of employment training? Does he have some type of mental challenge that's stopping him from learning? We try to find out what the needs of the kids are and then go get the service and provide the service to them, refer them to wherever they need to go to get help.
So essentially you're out there, you go out at night into sort of the hot spots of Oakland and talk to the kids on the corners.
Right.
And what do you say? And how do they respond to you?
Well, you know, I walk up and greet them. A lot of the kids out there, I know, they know who I am when I'm walking up to speak to them. So we greet each other and I just talk to them. I just, you know, ask them what's going on in their life. You know, I give them a little bit of my history. I give them a little bit of the do's and don'ts. This is what happened when I did this. This is what happened when I did something positive. I try to let them see a positive image. You know, I don't wear a bunch of jewelry and, you know, I don't do any drugs. I stay away from the negative, corrupt stuff in the community, and they see that. Some of them wonder how I did it. And then, you know, I get the opportunity to share with them how I did it and why I did it and what the gifts are from doing it. So, you know, I just service and find out what they want, what they need, what their interests are.
And do you feel like you have enough tools in the tool bag so if a kid tells you what I need is a job, what do you say to that person?
That's a good question. And what we're working on right now is we're doing a community mediation. So I'm pulling one guy from each hotspot area. For example, one guy from Ghost Town, one guy from the Acorn area, one guy from the Linden Street area. And I'm bringing them to a table and I'm inviting job coordinators, psychologists, job specialists. I invite a minister. So I try to meet them with what they need, like try to, you know, have people there to service these guys. And then I, you know, talk about if there's any issues, any territorial problems, can we solve it right here at the table?
That's Akhil Trousseau. He's a community organizer with Oakland Street Outreach Team. We're also joined by Paul Figueroa, who's interim assistant chief with the Oakland Police Department, and Gino Fajeda, who's deputy with the Alameda County Sheriff's Department and creator of the one-man show Cops and Robbers. And we want to have you join our conversation about what does good policing mean to you? What does it look like in your neighborhood? What could it look like? And if you're a member of law enforcement, what would help you do your job better? And how do you think you could actually provide the most benefit to the community? How do you build trust in the communities that you are serving? The number is 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also send us email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Again, we're talking on your call about what is good policing and how do we get there. And if you're somebody who tends to be skeptical or critical of law enforcement, what would you say that they could do better to meet your needs? 866-798-TALK. Again, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. Let me go to you, Paul, on this question of what is good policing? And obviously you've studied this a lot, right? Your dissertation is all about this. What does it mean to you?
Right. Well, one of the things Jay mentioned and Akhil certainly got to in terms of sitting people down is that trust is built on the foundation of relationship. And you just can't, you don't have one without the other. And so generally as a department and under Chief Wendt's direction, and he is really pushing this forward.
And he's the interim police chief in Oakland, Sean
yes.
Wendt. Yeah.
Yeah. The interim police chief. And because we know and understand that trust is built on the foundation of relationship where they can see why they should trust you. They can have interactions with you and they can see that you're concerned about them, that you're competent in what you're doing and that you do it with high integrity, which are the kind of the pillars of trust making decisions. So we as an agency are moving forward with that, with many of the programs and things that we're putting in place and really kind of the retooling of the police department. And
do you think that those are common, though, perceptions of police, that's the MO that people are operating under?
Well, I'll tell you what I think.
Okay.
Is that because of things in the past, because media certainly plays a role in it and how they portray things, not always accurate at times. And we have to try to get out in front of that sometimes and tell the real story behind it. What's not being told is all the things that we are doing to build relationship on the neighborhood level, in the living room level, in neighborhoods where we sit down and talk to folks in small groups and really build relationship. And as we increase our community policing efforts, as we increase what we're doing, those things are happening every day. And it's through those relationships, kind of organically, at the neighborhood level, backyard level in some instances, where we're really going to begin to change the perceptions. Because certainly the TV shows aren't helping. And many, oftentimes, the way the media reports things, I'm not going to overdo that. But things tend to get sensationalized at times. And what's not being told is the phenomenal work that Oakland police officers are doing and the sacrifices they're making on a daily basis. And it's when our Oakland residents, when I see that directly happening with my officers and we're building those relationships, that is when the community trust will really begin to step in at that point. And
so is this a new initiative?
It's an enhancement of what we had in place, and there are some new things being added. We have more community speakers in our police academy than ever before. There's an initial orientation now. We actually call recruits in 3 days early prior to the academy beginning, and there's a reception. They get to meet the community, and the community gets to talk to them. Community speakers come in. We give them an orientation. We rent a tour bus and take them around the city and describe the different neighborhoods to them. Akhil mentioned some of the West Oakland ones he's been working with to reduce violence. And so there are new things that we're doing, and we're also enhancing some of the things that are tried and true that we know have worked in the past. And then ceasefire is a big part of it as well.
So ceasefires, we're going to go to a break in just exactly a minute, so I want to be careful not to get into it. We can talk about ceasefire after the break. But do you think it's an issue that so many of the officers don't live in the communities that they're serving and don't come from them? I mean, this panel here is atypical of Oakland law enforcement.
As an Oaklander,
yeah.
I am so proud of the men and women that I work with. And if my child is sick, I have two daughters. If they were sick and I had to take them to Children's Hospital, I'm not going to stop to ask where the doctor lives. I want the best one in the hospital. And so I don't care where they live. They can fly them in if they have to. And that's what I expect of my Oakland police officers. Is it a kind of a more natural, organic thing because I've lived in Oakland to make phone calls and with people I've had a relationship with for 20 years, 20 plus years? Yes, that can make a difference. But it is not the difference maker. I want quality police officers who are committed to Oakland. And if they don't live in Oakland, I'm okay with that. I want the best.
And I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We're going to be right back after a short break.
Wait, in the worst way. And every time a little boy paralyzed with a bullet in his spine, 'cause You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. Take part in today's conversation. Call 866-798-TALK at 866-798-8255. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a message at yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's where you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, what is Coca-Cola's legacy? We'll talk with Mark Pendergrast, author of the book For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. It's a cultural, social, and economic history of America as seen through the green glass of a Coke bottle. Friday, of course, is our weekly media roundtable. We'll be speaking with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Today, we're asking the question, what is good policing? We're talking with Gino Fajeda, who's a rapper, performer, and now a deputy with the Alameda County Sheriff's Office. His one-man play, Cops and Robbers, shows the conflicts and misunderstandings between police officers and people on the street. And it raises the question for us, what does good policing look like? Do officers need to be from the communities that they are patrolling? And what do people actually want from the police? We're also joined by Assistant Chief of the Oakland Police Department, Paul Figueroa, and Oakland Street Outreach Team Leader Akil Trusso. And you can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also email us to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And right before the break, Paul, you brought up the program Ceasefire, which is Oakland's sort of newest, well, attempt. It was started, like 6 years ago, but didn't take. And now it is one of these strategies that Oakland is trying. It's a nationwide strategy that has had sort of mixed results. Can you explain in a nutshell what the philosophy behind Ceasefire is?
I can. And just before the break, the one final point I wanted to make on whether officers should live in the cities that they work in. The important things for us is that they do have some urban experience where they're exposed to different cultures and different communities. And there is an advantage if you're born and raised in a city. I have lived that advantage over the years in terms of being able to have those relationships and make phone calls. And we're doing a lot to recruit from within Oakland because we know that they're exposed to our wonderfully diverse community and bring some of that pride with them. So, we're working with the junior colleges to really recruit locally as well. So I did want to point that out.
And before we get to Ceasefire, I think, Gino, you had something that you wanted to say about whether or not cops should be living in the communities that they're serving, there's a danger there, right?
As Fake said, there's definitely an advantage to being born and raised there. Like I said, you're more effective at your job if people trust you. So you will have a greater advantage to gain that trust if you're from there and you'll already know a lot of people. But there is a reality that some of the element that you deal with as a police officer in the community, they're very violent people and they will want to do you harm and do your family harm. And if they know where you live, then it's that much easier for them to carry out that action. A lot of people in the community don't want to name drop. They don't want to tell because out of fear for their families. And as a police officer, you come into contact with the people that they're afraid of on a daily basis. So that's a truth that can be applied to officers as well.
It's okay. A very personal decision in terms of where you want to live, where, you know, what's the comfort level. But there are advantages, and we really want to. There are officers that have come out and in a very short time developed, not from Oakland, developed phenomenal relationships with the community. And so it's really a balance.
And you say you're putting more of an emphasis on training to be more culturally sensitive and to really kind of understand the communities that you are serving.
Yes, and a big part of that is to making sure they have that urban experience with different cultures and interacting with just a wide array of people.
Okay, so you were going to tell us about Ceasefire.
Yeah, so Ceasefire there's different versions throughout the nation, and we use a version where we call in offenders from our gangs, and it's in East Oakland right now, in East Oakland, and we basically lay out what the reality is, what the facts are, that it's likely they're engaged in the violence in the city, and we know that through the information that we have, and that if they continue to engage in violence, that we will exercise law enforcement authority and ensure that we pay attention to them and bring them to justice in many circumstances where they're committing crime. And we have to follow up on that promise if they engage in violence. And the bottom line is that the shooting has to stop. For those individuals who are willing to shoot others and engage in violence, that they have to get the message that the shooting has to stop. And if they don't, that's where we're there to back it up. And then the second part of that is that we let them know we love them. It's you know, their folks, they have a life. Jay was talking about how he's known some guys that have been in the game, and there's some good aspects to them. And I've grown up with folks that I've had to arrest in the past that are good people, who've done bad things, and that's just the reality. They're real people. They have families. They are rational, right? Nobody wants to get shot. Sometimes they wear it as a badge of honor after it happens, but before, trust me, nobody really wants to get shot. I mean, it's not something that's desirable. And so we let them know that we care about it and we want to intervene. And then, so the second piece to it is a lot of what the street outreach workers do. And we come in and say, look, there are some alternatives. And if you want to take advantage of those, we're here to help you. And we as law enforcement know that we can sometimes create a barrier to people wanting to be honest about what they need in their lives at this point. So we leave and we let the service providers spend time with them and make those offers. And it's the job of those individuals that we've brought to the call-in to get that message back to their groups that, hey, the police told us that if the shooting continues, that we're going to get the attention from them and they're going to back it up with various investigations, short and long term. And there are some alternatives for us. Not everyone's going to heed that message. And we know that. We've seen that. But the key is that we continue to have those regular meetings with them and let them know that we as a community are coalesced against the violence and that law enforcement is we're all rowing in the same direction. And if you're willing to shoot someone else in the city of Oakland, that we're gonna deal with you directly.
And do you think it's working?
I have seen instances where it's working. I mean, the numbers aren't as low as I would like them to be. I mean, any homicide is too many, right? And we went through some hiccups mid-year. We've had a change in command structure at the Oakland Police Department.
Hiccups, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, we're back on track. We are focused and rowing in the same direction. And I do believe we will see some crime reduction. And certainly to where it's at now, it's not where I would like to see it. And we have to reduce those. And, you know, the other thing is we've had a lot of high-profile homicides as well with young children being killed.
Yeah.
And it's tough. It's a difficult set of circumstances to deal with. But we're committed, we're focused, and we're moving forward.
And we've got a lot of callers on the line. I want to get to them. So I'm going to go through a number of callers and then get you guys to comment. But just briefly, do you want to go on the record and kind of explain what looked like a media debacle where you had this press conference saying ceasefire is working, we've just arrested 8 individuals, and then had to kind of come back last week and say, oh, they weren't really part of this?
That's been handled in the media already. I think we made it clear that there was an initial list that went out that had some names on it that shouldn't have been on it. And we've corrected that. And that's really what the story came down to. And so I don't know how things spun out in terms of how individuals thought things happened. But, you know, we're ready to move on past that. The correct list is out. And we encourage people to look at the latest information that's out there.
And let's go to callers. We've got full lines. Barbara in Santa Cruz, welcome to your call. Hi, Barbara. Do I have Barbara? All right. Should I go to Lark in San Francisco? Hi, Lark.
Hey. Yeah.
You're on.
Kind of a lighthearted comment and a very serious topic. I grew up with no interaction with police officers at all. And also I grew up with no car. And my first awareness of police officers at all was when I had friends. They'd be like, oh man, it's the cops, I'm gonna get a ticket. And my first image of police officers was like, who would ever in their right mind want to be a police officer? No one can stand them anywhere. So anyway, that's just...
Well, let's,
and
let's...
then later, my personal interaction with police officers, by the way, was always very positive. But anyway, it just occurred to me that everyone, it's kind of this general societal dislike of police officers.
Huh, that's interesting. I'm not sure that that's general, but let's hear what our panelists have to say. Do you feel that that's true? Let's hear from Jay.
I don't believe it's general. It's probably... it probably changes which circles you're dealing with. But ultimately, people see police when they're having a bad day in general. You know, that's when the police come out, when they're having a bad day. So we usually contact them at some of the worst points of their lives. So I can see how that opinion could develop over time, and it could be perceived as general. But we also solve the problem, you know, for the most part. So it depends on what circle you're dealing with.
Let's go to another call. Let's go to Grant in Santa Cruz. Hi, Grant.
Hi. Thanks for having the show. And I know I'm in Santa Cruz, which is a very different city and a very different situation with the police and the community. But I guess over the many years I've been here, I've seen we had for a while a civilian police review board, which seemed to me to be a very valuable asset to really having good public oversight of the police and their activities. And since that was done away with, I think, about 8 or 10 years ago, there seems to be no critical oversight of the police, and that often the city council and the mayor and people in power in the community are, I don't know, I think sometimes intimidated by the police, and certainly the police officers union. And there's just various scenarios that have happened where it seems as though this police actually get rewarded for poor procedures and things that have not been effective and have not done well. So I don't know if your panelists have anything to say about that.
Well, let's put it to them. Akhil is saying he wants to talk about that. Do you think that civilian oversight, should there be more?
Let me tell you something that happened in 2010. I was working at a emergency center in West Oakland after doing 18 to 20 years off and on in and out of prison committing crimes. I got stabbed by one of the citizens in the neighborhood. Now, I grew up in that area, you know. I know a lot of people in that area. I'm laying on the ground bleeding, and the only person who called the police besides the people in the emergency center that worked there was a cop. So I don't really understand why people are blaming the entire police force or saying they're not doing their job or they're not doing this or that, because there's going to be times when these people are going to be in an emergency situation. The first thing they're going to do is dial 911. Now, I'm not saying that there's not bad police. Of course there is. There's good and bad and everything. But I think we need to look at what they do right, instead of so much of what they do wrong, because we have to depend on the law to hold order.
And go ahead, Paul, about this question of civilian oversight.
Yeah, and so as one of the agencies probably most monitored in the nation, when we look at, we have a federal monitor that reviews our internal affairs cases, use of force, and just does a number of audits throughout our agency.
Because of the Ryder's case.
As a result, as the agreement related to the Ryder's case. And we also have a compliance director who's physically present here in Oakland and spends a lot of time with us looking at our work and providing some direction in some cases to the city on how to move forward. We also have a civilian police review board. We support it. I mean, we think that there are some models out there that have worked across the nation, and we're kind of wrestling with that now. In terms of what the final makeup will look like. But I assure you right now at the Oakland Police Department, there's a tremendous amount of oversight. And I think that some...
Is there resentment in the department because of that oversight, or is there buy-in now? Because that's part of the reason that there is so much oversight, is that the feds have decided that Oakland is not in compliance.
I wouldn't say there's resentment. There's always, certainly when it began, there was a lot of anxiousness in terms of, hey, you know, what's this going to look like? What does it mean for policing? And how is our job going to change? And so as we continue to kind of grow into these new procedures, for lack of a better way to describe it, there's that general anxiousness that you get in any organization where there's change. But we're moving forward, and I think people see a clear path forward in terms of some of the technology fixes that we need to put in place and some of the other things that can cause the anxiousness. So all that to say is we're still an organization in change, so there's going to be that general sense of what's going to happen tomorrow, that kind of thing. But those things are starting to come into focus now. The plans are in place. Some technology fixes are coming online that will help us really get a sense of what we're doing moving forward, as well as our community policing plans and really honing those down and focusing on what's working.
And that's Paul Figueroa. He's interim assistant chief with the Oakland Police Department. We're also joined by Akil Trusso, who's community organizer with the Oakland Street Outreach Team, and Gino Ferreira, who's a deputy with the Alameda County Sheriff's Department, and he's the creator of the one-man show Cops and Robbers. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We're talking about what makes for good and effective policing. I want to get to more of our calls. If you want to join our conversation, it's 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK is the toll-free number. I'll get to more calls in just one moment, but I want to ask you about the numbers. In the Oakland police force right now, there's 618 officers,
yes,
which is considered low for a city of the size of Oakland. How much do you think there's a need to bolster those numbers or to just deploy people more effectively? What's the balance there?
Definitely the numbers have to grow. I think in certainly my conversations from other agencies throughout the nation and even some external experts, the minimum number that we think is definitely above where we're at with 618, probably closer to 800 where we were. I know that's an ultimate target. Our current budget will get us up to 700.
And with attrition and the way that the police academies are putting out new officers, is that realistic? Like, are you on track to beef up the force?
We're about a year and a half away from really getting up to that 700 number. We've accelerated the time frame for an academy, and we're trying to bolster the numbers actually within the academy. So we're going to about as high as we can within our certifications to provide an academy, and that will definitely make a difference. I mean, we are just strapped for time. We're strapped in terms of what we can do because of the amount of staffing we have, and that's been well reported in numerous reports. And so we look forward to getting new staff on board. We have an academy graduating in late September or this month, and we look forward to getting those officers on the street.
Go ahead, Jay, and then I want to go to Jim in San Francisco. Hold on, Jim, just one second. Go ahead, Jay.
We talk about building relationships with the community, and if you don't have the numbers, then you're basically just going from call to call. There's no way to actually build relationships and present yourself to the people outside of an authoritative capacity. At the sheriff's office, you know, I'm in a new position with the Deputy Sheriff's Activities League and the COPS unit. And, you know, I'm basically at a community center and I can respond to calls as well. But I see that, you know, I see the officers that are out there on patrol and they just do patrol and they're call to call and I respond to that call with them. Half the time I know the people that are there because I'm in a position that calls for me to know the people that are there. And when I'm there, you know, after the officers are gone, I can hang around for a moment and maybe talk to them, maybe explain to them what happened. Because I explained when I was a kid, I didn't know any cops. I didn't know policy and procedure, and an average citizen doesn't, you know. But if more of the community knew police policies and procedures and they knew what we can do and what we can't do and what we might be thinking and why we just did that, then it would only come down to a situation of, well, do we trust this police agency or not?
Well, and I imagine that if you're an officer and you're just going from tragedy to tragedy, you get a very skewed perception of that neighborhood.
Well, it's definitely possible. But, you know, the screening process to become a cop is long and hard. And they try to, you know, weed those people out that would be most likely to fall victim to a skewed.
And there's so many people who want to talk to you guys. I want to try and get as many on as possible. Jim in San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Good morning.
Hi. Go ahead. Try and be brief because we're really running low on time.
Okay, guys. Does anybody know what the recidivism rate is in Oakland?
Well, it's a little hard to know because people go into the state system, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead. What is it, Paul?
Oh yeah, I don't have those figures in front of me. I've heard anywhere from 60% to 80% at times.
Yeah, it was about 70% for the California prison system.
Yes.
All right.
I don't have the Oakland specific numbers.
So what we do with the guys after we lock them up is just as important. And I've been working with a group that's recently been going into prisons and having some good luck with it. And it's a meditation program. It's called Peace Education Program. I'd just like to share that with you.
Well, thank you so much. Let's have Akil talk to that, because you're somebody who was in prison and had to get out as a parolee. It's not that easy to rebuild a career.
It's not. It's really not. But what I've noticed, what I found out was, you know, we can transfer our skills. So, you know, for example, I like to hang on the street. I like to be around thugs, criminals, and gangsters. So today, I am still around thugs, criminals, and gangsters. I just don't participate in their activities. So I like doing what I like doing. I like being around that. So the guys that go to prison, we just have to try to find out what it is that they like to do. A lot of guys like to sell drugs. Instead of that, they can sell candy. They can sell ice cream. They can sell food. They can still be salesmen. So it's just about transferable skills.
And can I ask both you, Jay and Akil, a lot of the time I think the public has the perception that criminal life is an irrational choice. What do you think is the appeal of what you guys have called the thug life? Go ahead, Jay.
Well, first of all, especially growing up in the crack epidemic, it's a very rational choice. I mean, if you just sit on the porch and the guy sitting on the porch next to you is selling drugs, you may see him make thousands of dollars in that day in the 80s, and you're sitting right next to him. So it seems to be very rational to, you know, make thousands of dollars as well. But, you know, we can't ignore, there's a lot of conversation, just, you know, placing it squarely on the shoulders of the individual and the community. We can't ignore the hundreds of millions of dollars that are spent in the entertainment industry, promoting thug life, promoting negative stereotypes, and glamorizing violence in movies and film, on the nightly news. You know, you start off with violence. A large portion of the program is violence. Reality television, it puts ignorance on display, and it glamorizes it, and it takes those actors and those characters that are in the programs and it enhances them millions of dollars. It rewards them for it. So if you have a youngster, especially a youngster with limited guidance at home, and, you know, they're being raised by the television and they're being raised by, you know, the movies and
you said the streets
and the streets, then you can't expect much more. Anything is possible, but it's highly likely that they would go into that life. So as Akil said, transferring the skills, that's something very real. If you don't have a realistic way for them to participate legally in an economy, then you're kind of sealing their fate, and we need to call for that. You know, people need to stand up and call for that. People need ones that want. They need ones that want it. They need a realistic way to participate in the economy. And then, as Fig said, the ones that are left over that make the decision to go into the underworld and stay there because they love it and they're attached to it, then they need to be dealt with.
Let's go to more callers. Kevin in Oakland, welcome to your call.
Thank you. I'm going to be quick. I feel like I'm a bit of an anomaly. I'm a peace officer right now in Alameda County, with probation. But growing up, I grew up in East Oakland. You know, down the street there were the pimps and the prostitutes, the drug dealers, the gangsters, the whole nine. But the cops that did come around my neighborhood were nice. They were all white, but they were nice people. They were actually friends of mine at the time. And I mean, we had such a rapport that, you know, I would be allowed to get in the car, you know, while they were working, and they were actually doing maybe like a speed trap, and they'd chase the car down, light them up, and then once they pull them over, they say, "All right, you got to get out." You know, this was back in the late 70s, mid to late 70s. So, you know, that aspect of it was more of a situation. I'm pretty sure they did not live in the community. They did not live in Oakland, you know, as some of the people that I've worked with, and I was with the Sheriff's Department for about 7 years, and the people that I've worked with, they live way, way out
Well, Kevin, it's so great to hear from you. Thank you so much for calling. And it sounds like the officers in your area were doing sort of a community policing at that time. I want to get to an email from Pauline as we close out the show. Why are your speakers surprised that police attract a lot of criticism? Don't they have a shoot to kill policy? They always seem to get off or receive light sentences when they've been involved in outright homicide of unarmed suspects. And that's a big criticism, particularly in Oakland. With Oscar Grant and Alan Bluford, et cetera. Paul, do you want to respond to this this email?
Well, I don't agree with the foundation of it, but I'll just respond in terms of how we handle it. Our shootings are investigated by the district attorney's office. We do an internal criminal investigation through our internal affairs division as well as our criminal investigation division. And our shooting investigations are reviewed by federal monitors. We get feedback, comment, and by a compliance director now. And so there's a lot of oversight that's in place. And if a crime takes place, that's really the purview of the district attorney to make that decision.
And only because we're running completely out of time, can I just hear from Jay? What do you think are some of the misconceptions that police and the communities that they serve have about each other, and how can we break through some of that?
I don't want to go into the misconceptions. I just want to point out that the community and the police in general don't know enough about each other. And I believe more homework needs to be done on that end. You know,
and you're saying on both sides?
On both sides.
And Akil is nodding his head here saying yes.
Yeah. And I just want to say that this is a message to the community and to the people, the brothers and sisters that come from the background that I come from. It's 74% of our nation dying, killing each other between the age of 13 and 35. We got to stand up and take responsibility for that and stop shooting each other and stop complaining about the police shooting us.
That's Akil Trusso. He's with Oakland Street Outreach Team. We've also been joined by Paul Figueroa, Assistant Chief with the Oakland Police Department, and Gino Ferreira, Deputy for the Alameda County Sheriff's Department, and his new one-man show, Cops and Robbers, will be out in audio. Thanks to everybody. I'm so sorry that we couldn't get to all of your calls. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. What is Coca-Cola's history and why does it matter? On the Next Year Call, we'll have a conversation with Mark Pendergrast, author of For God, Country, and Coca-Cola, the definitive history of the great American soft drink and the company that makes it. Pendergrast says the soft drink's history is a microcosm of the American story. How did Coca-Cola become such a powerful global corporation? Join the conversation on Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.